This is Dialogue Conspiracy. Political research specialist Mae Brussel, whose conspiracy newsletter appears in the Realist magazine, has for 3 years shared with our listeners the fruits of her decades' research into political assassinations and the abuses of power in America. Her weekly commentary relates the news of the week to the evidence emerging about the conspiracy, which allegedly maintains its power by force over America's electoral and executive processes. And now, here's Mae.
Good afternoon on Dialogue Conspiracy, Monday, May the 20th. It's hard for me to do this show this week. I don't think that in the years that I've done research into political assassinations, I felt quite as badly as I did this last weekend when I saw the war coming closer to home. I've worked very hard for 10 years researching the political conspiracies in this country, the assassination of President John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Medgar Evers, 200-300 other Whitney Young musicians, rock stars, you name it, judges, writers, civil rights leaders, the outline of a book, Murderville, USA. But the blood just keeps flowing on, and it comes in living color on your television. And the news media is called in preparation for the event by a public relations firm in Los Angeles so that you can sit at home and watch six people be burned alive inside of a building. I spoke about Donald Freese on many shows in the Bay Area in April. I was speaking about him. I had a solution for the whole thing. He easily could have been understood, adopted, given a home. The game of death could have been ended and over without the help of the law enforcement agencies. They were pushed into this corner, and those people were killed. And there will be more killings, and what you saw burning in Los Angeles is a sample. If my predictions are right as they've been before, you'll see every 10th home on fire within 2 or 3 years in this country, like that scene in Los Angeles, if we allow these people to get away with what they are doing. It was a cold-blooded assault and attack. 500 police officers, the accounts range between 400 to 500 police officers, special task squads. The fire department was not allowed to enter a building at 2,000 degree temperature. One black man, five women, and a pet cat. And they all died. The most disgusting scene. And I have many things I want to talk about, and we'll try to touch a few of them. March 15th in the LA Star, I had an article called "The SLA is the CIA." It has to do with the behavior modification programs in our prison, the CIA in our prisons, the National Security Council giving authority to the police department in Los Angeles and other police departments up and down the state of California that allowed this monster thing to happen. April the 7th, I published an article in the Berkeley Barb called "Is SLA Sin Q the First Black Lee Harvey Oswald?" And on the first page of that paper, it said, "The whole nation will be involved in Patty's fate, and they will sacrifice her. Donald DeFreeze and Thurl Wheeler would be the patsies." Wheeler has not surfaced. He is somewhere, I don't know where. There was a second black man in that house, and he left before it was burned down. I went on to say that Donald DeFreeze would be the main patsy, the first black Lee Harvey Oswald. He would wind up dead. He would be sacrificed. He would have to die. The intelligence agencies behind the plot didn't plan that Patty Hearst, Donald DeFreeze, and Thurl Wheeler would survive and tell their story. The whole plot for the paramilitary takeover of the United States might come out in the open if the truth is revealed about that kidnapping. And I went on to say many more people will be murdered, and they will. May the 10th, there was a press conference in San Francisco at the law office of Charles Garry. Those of you that listen to Dialogue Conspiracy know that we played the entire press conference on my program last week because I didn't want to delete it. I wanted to show you what the major news media hears but doesn't carry. The Associated Press, United Press, the LA Times, the Washington Post, that's supposed to be so understanding and investigative in its research. Leroy Ahrens was there. New York Times carried it. The story they carried went into their issue this Friday, the same Friday that Donald DeFries was murdered by the L.A. Police Department that had used him in previous work as an agent provocateur informer for them. The same day that the story broke in New York, Donald DeFries was being burned alive in California. There was an article in the San Francisco Chronicle about Donald DeFries on May the 13th, and then the following day they had an article, Donald DeFries' letter to a judge. And I think maybe to think of him as a human being and used by our police agencies, I may spend a good share of the program just reading where his mind was at when he was sent to jail and before they sent him to Vacaville, to behave in a way that his mind was controlled, that he would be this great leader. The inconsistency of his being Martin Luther King or Malcolm X is ridiculous. The Muslims are not armed, and Malcolm X was not armed. So the great machine gun trip and the weapon trip, at the same time, his head being told he's a hero in the image of the nonviolent leaders while shooting out, is totally inconsistent. His brain was scrambled, and the boy was meeting with agents of the Central Intelligence Agency that work in our prison system, and they created that heroic figure that was forced to die in Los Angeles. There's a lot of things that run through my mind. One of them is a story in the LA Times. It said, the battle plan that crushed the SLA, and it's written by Jerry Cohn. He's the same Jerry Cohn on the desk. They have departments there, you know, like food and news and sports and so forth. Jerry Cohn is the conspiracy writer. He's the man who doesn't explore the Tackwood allegations, who can ignore them if he thinks they're right. He doesn't put them down, but he ignores the leads. He's the one who tells you that Sirhan killed Robert Kennedy or that Lee Harvey Oswald killed President John Kennedy. And Jerry Cohn waits. He doesn't put anything about the evidence that Donald DeFries could be a police agent or worked with the Attorney General Evel Young or the police department or what happened to him at Vacaville or who let him escape from Soledad and who didn't pick him up in Berkeley in the 10 months since he escaped that allowed all these things to take place. Nothing, no investigative reporting of that kind. But when it's all over, when their particular man is dead, he writes an article called The Battle Plan That Crushed the SLA, and you may want to hear how he describes the battle, the siege that took place down there. The same day, on May the 18th, Los Angeles Times has an article, a policeman calls back to the command post and says there's a black man with a rifle believed to be inside. They weren't even sure that there was. And the radio message was, if you see him, nail him. And that meant get Donald DeFries. That doesn't mean save the others or bring them out alive so we can question them. In other words, to find out who the SLA is or what's on their mind or to understand what was happening with this group. The UCLA School of Study of Violence only studies dead patsies and then emulates theories. They make up these big theories about the causes of violence after the main patsies that are used are locked up in jail. They want to have an institute to study violence, and they still are squeaking for it. And I know that this big scene of violence in L.A. will give them an excuse all the more to study violence, not the violence of a police order that says, if you see him, nail him. Not to protect him, but if there's a man in there, nail him. And that's what they were after. And they didn't care who else was in the house. Well, the story of the battle plan was that some woman had five grandchildren that were staying with her, and they shared this cottage. And one of them saw a white woman and a strange black man and white man sitting on the floor. Now, I don't know why he would be strange to them. It's a black part of town. And what was so strange about him? This was the excuse to go in. And they had, she said, guns and ammunition. And the children reported this to the woman, who told the police that she was worried that there was somebody in the cottage with guns and ammunition. So at 2 o'clock, at 2 p.m. on Friday, the big roll call room at the Newton Street Police Division station house was the scene for a momentous meeting. Present were top-level police officers, including Assistant Chief Daryl Gates and perhaps a half a dozen FBI, including William Sullivan, in charge of the federal agency's L.A. office. For almost an hour, they talked and planned, thrashing out a course of action and deciding when to put it into operation. Now, all they knew was that there was a strange-looking black man with these women sitting on the floor, and the child said there were some weapons. Commander Hagen, the department's public relations chief, arrived with an aide, Officer Harold Webster. Hagen was present because he had been informed by a colleague that an operation is coming down that will require a public relations spokesman. Now, Lewis Tackwood, in his book, The Glass House Tapes, published by Avon Press, tells you that the office called Public Relations in the Los Angeles Police Department is the head of the criminal conspiracy section that's linked up and down this state, that is tied up to the White House, the higher echelons of government, and that is a cover. The public relations is a cover. But these men were not prepared to save lives, save homes, property, neighborhood, or anything. They first job was to call a public relations spokesman, and they certainly did a good job of that. It says Hagen recalls it was Captain Marvin King, the commander of the Investigative Headquarters Bureau, who crystallized the thinking of the men in the roll call room and said, well, we'll get in on it this evening. And they were placed in charge of the impending operation. The meeting broke up at 3 o'clock. A command post was established, 57th Street in Compton. Being the command post was a black and white station wagon with maps, ultra-modern communications equipment, and the police units throughout had special radio frequencies, and 150 L.A. policemen, 100 FBI agents, 100 sheriff's officers, 15 California Highway Patrol were to be on duty in the neighborhood. Now, with that many people on duty in the neighborhood, all they had to do was stake out the place for 2 weeks, and somebody would have come out. The SLA has not done the violence that they would have you believe, and they didn't give them a chance to stake it out. They decided the public relations office was called, and that many people were ready. The command post was set up, and they had their quarters. The first to arrive at the post were three special weapons and tactics teams, the SWAT team, a total of 20 policemen, and they would be the officers exposed to gunfire if it came. They donned special overalls, flak vests, each carried semi-automatic weapons. The FBI came in with flak vests, and the agents got down on the ground ready for the actions. At 5:15, the first units, left by Captain King and Sullivan, moved out of a parking lot, followed by a horde of newspaper reporters, photographers, television, and radio crews. This is like Jack Ruby killing Lee Harvey Oswald in the camera. The police would not feel guilty for killing Donald DeFries at this point. If you watch it on television, they feel they have nothing to hide. And they had called in hordes of newspaper reporters to get ready for the action, photographers, televisions, radio crews. If they expected shooting or action, there's no reason, absolutely no reason at all, for this scene to be televised, for people to see it. They're testing your tolerance, like in Nazi Germany or the concentration camps or whatever. How much can you tolerate of watching these people burn inside this house? Because keep in mind, they didn't even know who was in the house by their own admission. And I'll read you some of the articles. They didn't know how many or who, but everything, the public relations office was set up, the newspaper reporters, the television, and the radio crews, and scores of other media representatives, having learned by various means by the FBI and the police, their destination was known, and they appeared. And at 5:15, the officers approached, rifles poised. Another with a flak vest stood in front of the house. Neighbors and newsmen watched. Now, the newsmen, whose number later estimated 100, were all there. Many reporters arrived in time to see an officer point a bullhorn at the residence and hear him order its occupants to come out. Now, it says many arrived on time to see him point a bullhorn, but the next day there wasn't a person who heard the bullhorn warning. There was no witness on the street that said they heard the bullhorn warning. And then it says 2 minutes later, a member of the SWAT team stuck directly in front of the cottage, leveled a gas gun at it, and fired into it, and a tear gas grenade shattered the window. From then, a deafening fusillade of gunfire came. The battle was joined. At least 1,000 shots went back and forth before it was over, and this was a conservative amount. What unfolded in the next hour is familiar to hundreds of thousands who watched the event on television, newspaper, and radio. The police believe the fire, which started at 6:30 p.m., leveled the cottage, was one, either set by the tear gas grenades fired into the dwelling, or the terrorists resigned their fate, chose a spectacular way to die. They exhibited incredible discipline, staying in the blazing house and firing back. Somebody went to the window, their clothes were ablaze, and they were dead. Now, the various reports that I have here, all different kinds of newspaper accounts coming in. I take 8 papers a day. One says 500 law officers were present. They went to the suspected house. The house was inflamed, thousands of rounds of ammunition, 7 canisters of tear gas. The police were unable to say whether they were members of the SLA. This is the LA Times that came out late Saturday night, Sunday morning. They were unable to say whether they were the SLA. It was unconfirmed, while all the action was going on, that Donald DeFries was in the house. But they were willing to take a risk that it was him and not 6 other people. It didn't matter if Patricia Hearst was in there, who was in there. Donald DeFries, like I said in my article, like Oswald, had to be killed because he knew what had been happening to him, who had done it, and he had to be cornered. I'm sure he was lured into this particular place and was sure they'd be safe, and he was not safe. Nobody, this is the LA Times, May 19th, nobody was able to say exactly what caused the fire. It was seen from a war. They described it as a war scene. Two officers were treated at California Hospital. One officer was struck in the stomach by concrete hurled from an unknown source, and another stumbled during the fight. There was a discrepancy on the house. The one woman said she lived at the house, and Miss Johnson, who was supposed to be a hostage, said that she lived at the house. And then Mary Carr said that her daughter lived at the house. So 2 people were claiming to live at the house, and the circumstances, as in all these conspiracies, are very shady. Mrs. Carr said that she saw a white lady with a belt on with a pistol, and that's why she called the police. And the law enforcement started at 5:30. By 6:45, the shooting had stopped, and all of those people were dead. I can't get over the horror of it. I don't know why I'm not surprised. Like Richard Nixon said, they have the marshals, we have the army. In the tapes, the White House tapes, he talks about it's a war. You take a few, you give a few. And if you believe, maybe you don't believe, that there's a war in America, that the intelligence agencies are operating upon us and making these things happen, maybe you don't believe it. But I've researched for 10 years, and I believe it, and I believe it so strongly that I can predict their next move. And when they do their next move, I wish I was wrong. I wish that historically over the last few years I proved to be wrong instead of right, and that my theories would fall apart and they didn't behave the way I thought they would behave, because every consistency that they move with confirms all the more the fact that the battle is not in Vietnam any longer. It's in California, the headquarters of the fear and terror that will spread across the country if we allow it to go further than California. You know, down at UCLA, there was that controversial school for the last year. They've been trying to pass this school, the section of it, the study of violence, the plan for the study of violence. But just this week, Chancellor Young, Charles E. Young, this Saturday, came out and said he was in favor of studying violent behavior. He said it is really a social science, a kind of program trying to look at the basic causes of violence. Now, I've been fighting the idea of that school studying the causes of violence for a long time, unless they go into the violence of the police department, the men who ordered nail him, the violence of the people who go after a group in a building and don't give them more than 2 minutes, if that, to clear out, that burn them alive, and then call in people to watch it on television, call in the cameras and the press to cover it all over the world to see as if they're pleased with what they've done. The problem with that school down at UCLA is they're not studying the violent people. They're studying the victims of violence. And that's my objection to the school. Now Chancellor Young says he thinks it would be a good idea. It was the director of the school, if it goes through, or the Institute to Study Violence, Jolly West, the psychiatrist that was called in to see Jack Ruby, who set up at Santa Cruz recently at a conference, I wouldn't touch a prisoner's brain. I wouldn't do anything, put electrodes or psychosurgery or anything. He said he was very disgusted that the people were accusing him of wanting to do these things. And it could be documented that they were planning these things. And he said, you aren't ready for it. He says, you'll be ready. He implied, he used the word ready, that someday they'll be ready. And I predicted we'd see a lot of violence in California, similar to this thing that was televised on the weekend. Then people like Charles Young come right back in and say, oh, now we better study our violence on the tails of this latest SLA thing. If a handful of people can tie up the country, we better study out what's in their brains and see what makes them violent. Now, William Saxby, the Attorney General, has called Patricia Hearst a common criminal. They will get her. They've created the excuse today to set up, they're pressing all these charges. They're so anxious to press charges so that if they kill her, people will realize that they only got another dirty criminal. They can't accept the fact that in 90 days she could be brainwashed, injected, hypnotized, programmed, and give the image of middle America or upper class America, in her case, mingling with ex-prisoners, blacks, do-gooders, social workers, the image that she has to be destroyed, that it gets her in trouble, and she has to die with a lot of them. Nobody's going into the extensive control of the mind that's going on in this country by the Defense Department, Stanford Research, all across the country, and realize that she could be a victim. And they press these charges night and day, every 10 minutes on the radio today, and it's disgusting. Clarence Kelly said last week or so, if we know where she is, we will go in and get her. And the victims of this thing have said the FBI wants them dead. It's part of the script. They wouldn't give them a chance no matter what. And the LA police chief says, if they fire first, we will fire back. Well, I remember the Isla Vista riots down in Santa Barbara when Captain Honey Fritz of the Sheriff's Department, and this came out in testimony in a trial when he was scolded for what went on down at that riot, and one of the things he instructed his co-workers to do was carry some extra guns, and if you see some students and you kill them, burn the building with them inside and drop the guns to make it look, you know, like they were shooting at us. Self-defense, burn it down and kill the students. Now that's what goes on in California if we don't break this thing open. We can write to congressmen. If 3 years ago I told you we wouldn't have out the Attorney General, John Mitchell, or Patrick Gray or Richard Nixon or Mr. Haldeman or Ehrlichman or Spiro Agnew or Robert Mardian or Frederick LaRue, all of these people are out because they're out on simple things, perjury, not for the crimes they did, but for lying that they didn't know. But the point is they can be out and they can lose their law degrees, Donald Segretti and all of them. So one of the things we have to do, really have to do, is if you're angry about this whole cremation down in Los Angeles and what's going to follow, write to members of Congress and Sam Ervin, Senate Select Committee. This is called Watergate West. And put it at the top of your letter, Watergate West, and say, based upon the allegations, the opening up of the Robert Kennedy assassination in Los Angeles, which involved the same Los Angeles Police Department. We'll talk about that for a few minutes. They tried to open this up last week at the Board of Supervisors. In lieu of the lies that were told in the Robert Kennedy assassination, that a second gunman is out, the media covered it up, the investigators have covered it up. In lieu of that, in lieu of the chief law enforcement people in the state being defendants in a trial for cutting it up, for covering this up and never going to trial, and secondly, with the allegations of Lewis Tack, with all of his predictions and all of his references coming true and working in the same department as Donald DeFries and the LAPD, and all this blood and terror coming down in California, the Tagwood allegations as they link to the Watergate, the Robert Kennedy assassination, and now this, what's happening with the SLA, the CIA equals SLA. Congress has to go into this. There's no one in California in the assembly up in Sacramento that can handle it. It's Watergate West. It's a national problem. It involves the Central Intelligence Agency, the Phoenix Program, the military. It's like the Manson case was a military murder. Manson played a small part in that massacre. These are social massacres to effect social changes, terror in the community, come down against people working with prisoners, come down against lesbians, bring in new laws, bring in new police forces, new weapons, show how ineffective the FBI was so that they can combine the military with the FBI. There's 15 motives I've gone through on my program over and over since last January on this SLA and where it was going to lead and what would happen, and they're all coming true. So write to members of Congress, the Judiciary and Senate Select Committee, and say, we want to open up Watergate West and get all these allegations on the table. Don Fried, who wrote Executive Action and worked with Louis Tachman on Glasshouse Tapes, has 400 pages of documentation of the role of Donald DeFried with the L.A. Police Department. So isn't it terrible that 1 week after this exposure comes out, that these documents exist, that man had to be burned alive in that terrible inferno and sacrificed, and whoever was with him, it didn't matter. The very proof that they didn't know that Patty Hearst wasn't in there was the fact that they found a sixth body the next day, more than almost 48 hours afterwards. So if there's one more, then they certainly didn't know she was or wasn't there. So the point was to get DeFried because the evidence came out about what happened to Donald DeFries. The San Francisco Chronicle had a cover story, the usual media smear, a chronology of violence to violence. And they have the long story of Patricia Hearst kidnapping going from November the 6th to May the 18th, and they have listed about 30 dates. Well, what violence was there? Start November the 6th, 73, an Oakland school superintendent, Marcus Foster, is assassinated, and his aide, Robert Blackburn, is wounded in an ambush. Now, that happened, and two men are in Oakland jail for that. So that didn't involve all these people that are burned and being chased down in Los Angeles if they're looking for an excuse for why they had to kill them and overkill 500 people to six with the weapons they had. Then they go down to arson in the case of Nancy Ling Perry in that house. But that house also burned down right-wing literature, American military manuals, rise and fall of the Third Reich, plans and ambushes, rental car plans, military plans. They were burning as much a right-wing Nazi Minutemen plan to kill Dr. Foster and hide their traces as they were any radical group. Patricia Hearst kidnapped February the 4th. Now, is the excuse to burn down the house on May the 17th because Patricia Hearst was kidnapped? Are they burning the victim? Is that the way violence leads to violence, that you burn the victim of a kidnapping? To what to prove? And then all the other things that are listed here. Our letters to KPFA, SLA communiques, People in Need program, Cecil Williams has an SLA message, second day of food distribution, third day of food, Hearst Corporation puts up $4 million. So you read the whole list, and there's no violence. There are letters that are going back and forth. Police locate two rented autos. They say two people were shot at the bank holdup. I've never heard any follow-up on their hospitalization, the extent of the damage. They're living. They weren't killed. Nothing justified. So far, the shooting of the SLA was to shoot two people outside the bank as they left. If those people were seriously injured, nobody in the state knows about it. And that wouldn't justify burning six people and 500 military men against that little cottage. Furthermore, the neighbors didn't even have a chance to get out. Nobody was warned. They were striving across the street, around schoolyards, into other people's homes, damaging completely three homes. Certainly a bank robbery doesn't justify that military action down there. I don't understand what justified. So in order to build a long chronology out of nothing, they have the Marcus Foster violence listed, and then that's it. And there isn't anything else. Oh, yes. Mr. Harris took a pair of socks. Imagine. They rob a bank and become conspicuous. They take a pair of socks and exchange, leave a gun that's registered in their names. All of this defies reasoning. They rent a room and say, I'm Tanya. They pick up a man, say, I'm the SLA. It defies all reason, and it suggests very heavily behavior modification. at every level. Now, it doesn't surprise me that these things happen. It hurts me. But in the same news after the press conference last week, since I met with you and talked with you, what are the three stories I pick up here? One is the investigators fail in bid for the JFK files. Here's a man, Harold Weisberg, who's written four books on the John Kennedy assassination, who used to work at the FBI, who sought reports, FBI reports, on certain bullet fragments taken from John Kennedy's body, another public assassination for all the world to see. He said the Warren Commission wasn't given the full reports and based its conclusions on inadequate and misleading information. And Harold Weisberg placed a suit that's gone up from the lower courts up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court refused to review an appeals court decision that the FBI can keep all the Kennedy files secret under the provision of the Freedom of Information Act. Now, Weisberg said, he made it clear, he said, the courts acted as rubber stamps all along the way. They allow secrecy, even though no federal law was violated in this case. No prosecution is contemplated by checking these bullets out, and disclosure would not harm the agency's legitimate law enforcement functions. Well, Harold Weisberg is wrong about that. If the truth of the Kennedy assassination were out, it would harm the agency's legitimate law enforcement function, because it seems that their legitimate function is to represent the status quo. And when you kill somebody, they seem to think it's legitimate. In their interpretation, it lends, the way you use the term national security, it lends to two different views of what they mean. But the FBI will not allow anybody to examine evidence that Oswald did not kill John Kennedy. Weisberg said photographic analysis could further determine if different guns were used by finding trace elements incompatible with Oswald's weapon. So 10 years later, the same FBI, it hasn't changed faces or changed hands with administrations. Mr. Kelly hasn't changed a thing. The Supreme Court hasn't changed from Earl Warren to Warren Burger. And the Supreme Court turned down a 10-year struggle to prove that the rival that Oswald had did not kill President Kennedy. And the same day that they turned that down, May the 14th, Baxter Ward opened up in Los Angeles the evidence of a second gun in the Robert Kennedy shooting. And he brought out a lot. There were three witnesses at the hearing. The LA Times did have an article, not by Jerry Cohn, the persistent question of whether Sirhan acted alone in the assassination of Senator Robert Kennedy or whether an overlooked second gunman was involved, reopened Monday by the Los Angeles County Supervisor Baxter Ward. There was a three-hour public hearing. Eight scientific experts and county officials testified. Criminologist Herbert Leon McDonald, director of the Laboratory of Forensic Science in New York, said the two bullets taken from the ambassador pantry did not come from the same gun. One bullet that was marked by coroner Thomas Noguchi was taken from Senator Kennedy. The other was marked with the initial Dwayne Wolfer, head of the Los Angeles Police Department Crime Lab, from the stomach of newsman William Weissel. The bullets don't match each other in their manufacture or the manner in which they were marked as in the passage when they went through the gun barrel. The testimony, the firearms testimony, was backed up by criminologist William Harper, who for 35 years worked as a forensic expert for prosecution and defense in local trial. And Thomas Noguchi, who did the autopsy, revealed he started 2 days after the Kennedy assassination to explore the possibility of neutron activation analysis of the bullets and bullet fragments taken from the pantry. And then he was advised not to do this. And although his evidence of where the bullets came, Thomas Noguchi, was not consistent with where Sirhan was standing. After the hearing, the district attorney's office deferred to Lynn Buck Compton for a response. And the district attorney said this was simply a political ploy, that there wasn't anything involved, and they put it down, even though criminologists from all over the country have been working on this case. And so the Robert Kennedy situation is wide open. The fact that Sirhan did not fire the fatal gun or did not get any bullets into Robert Kennedy, and the Supreme Court the same day was turning down the evidence that Oswald did not shoot into President John Kennedy. And if that isn't enough, May the 14th, the Boston announced, the Associated Press, that the House Judiciary Committee, which is considering impeachment proceedings, has requested a full set of records of the closed inquest into the death of Mary Jo Kopechne. They summoned from the judiciary, the social law library, and Suffolk County Courthouse and requested a full set of copies of the records and the lawyer's brief in the case. A girl named Margaret Carroll, who was Mary Jo Kopechne's roommate at the time of the incident, filed a suit last August charging the White House aide John Ehrlichman and two former city policemen White House payroll took part in illegal wiretapping on her phone. They were Anthony Laskowitz and John Caulfield. And if you read the White House tapes, there's the mention of Laskowitz doing a favor, a good job for Richard Nixon. Kalmbach gave Tony Laskowitz $100,000 the summer of 69. Caulfield and Laskowitz and Hunt and all of them were involved in the Chappaquiddick affair. And if the truth were open, if the judiciary would ever go into there and they're too afraid to touch it or the Wallace shooting, you would find that Ted Kennedy was not driving a car. And it's very important to open this up, but I think they're too afraid. I don't think a million letters would force them to open this up because they'd have to face all their lies and all their cover-ups and indiscretions and ignoring the truth for the past 10 years. But the top people that I mentioned that are out of office are moving out and will be, if not in prison, lose their law degrees and demoted from positions of power. So we have to write about the Donald DeFries affair and the burning of these people and the slaughters in California. Where is the blame for all of this? Where is it coming down? Where does it lie? It has to go from the top down. It can't just happen at the street level. If you read Tackwood's book, if you study the prison conspiracies, the state conspiracies, it has to have approval from the top, the National Security Council, Army Intelligence. A lot of them were involved, like the Manson thing, the safe houses, the Barker Ranch, Spahn Ranch. This terror that's coming in California has to have the approval of the Attorney General, and he sits every day with the National Security Council. Another problem is the CIA in the police departments, the use of their provocateurs, their fomenting violence, the use of Stanford research and behavior modification. We should stop all of that now. Colston Westbrook, the military man from Southeast Asia, going into the Vacaville prisons, right from a CIA program, AID, to a man like Donald DeFries who worked for the LA Police Department. These things have to be stopped. There is a way to stop it if we had an ability to subpoena the files of these people and what they were doing. Now, after Donald DeFries was dead, the San Jose Mercury comes out with an article, a puzzling figure, the man Sin Q, who was he? They said he was commanded, to those he commanded, he was a prophet, a leader in the tradition of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. That was the image they gave him. I have about 7 minutes, and maybe I can read in 7 minutes, a letter Donald DeFries wrote to a judge before he was turned into a zombie at Vacaville by the CIA and the California Department of Corrections. He was in 1970, he had been serving the LAPD as an informer. He had been kept from 9 serious charges. Now he was going to jail. It was 1970 and he didn't want to go. "Dear sir," he wrote to the judge. These are excerpts from the letter. I only have time. He wrote it 1970 on a robbery charge shootout to Los Angeles County Superior Court Judge William L. Ritzy, R-I-T-Z-I. "Dear sir, I know you may think I'm trying to be funny or smart because I sent you a motion for a recall of sentence and commitment and you denied it. I'm sending you another one with this letter. What I want to do is just talk to you. That's all. I want you to hear the truth of everything. You never gave me a chance to talk or anything. I am in jail, but I still want to let you know what really happened and why. I'm going to talk to you truthfully, and like I'm talking to God, I will tell you things that no one has ever known. To start a story of a man's life, you can't start at the end of this story. You start at the age 16. At that age, I just got out of a boys' school. I did 2.5 years for breaking a parking meter and stealing a car, and the judge said that is the best place for you. and I hated it. I never had a home. Prison was my home. There was nothing but fear or hate there, day in, day out. It was maddening. I only had two fights. I stayed out of fights. I wanted to be friends with everyone. This other inmate would not allow it. They'd try to make fights. They'd try somehow to make a homosexual out of me. I found myself hated by the boys out there, and I got out of jail. People couldn't believe I'd ever been to jail. I worked hard. I didn't drink or pills. I didn't curse. I didn't hang out at night in the street. I believed in God. I tried to lead a good life, and I was still lonely. I didn't love anyone, and didn't anyone love me, and I had a few girlfriends. But as soon as their mother found out I'd been in jail, that was the end. Then one day I met Gloria, and she was nice, and I fell in love. I was 18, and life was real to me. I asked her to marry me. My wife had three kids, and we were married, and things were lovely for a few months. And I worked, and while I was at work, she had relations with a friend, and I was very, very mad and hurt. And I told the boy he could have her if he wanted her, and she him before I killed someone. And the boy said he didn't want her at all. And that's where his violence began, when he was betrayed by the person he loved. He didn't kill or hurt, but that's how he felt. He said he found out my wife's kids all had different fathers, and that she had never been married. But he went back to her, and then later the boss comes to his house, and his wife is nude. And that hurt him, you know, and she was playing these games on him. I closed my eyes to it all. I loved her and the kids, and I did everything I could. And I thought if we had kids or a baby, we'd be closer. And when the baby was born, it was the same thing she was doing over again. And I started to drink, and she wanted a divorce. And I became completely destroyed. And then I got a hammer and destroyed everything in the house I bought her. I mean, everything. And she begged me to take her back, and she said she had made a mistake and really loved me and made a home for me and my kids, and he had three children with her. And then she began to chase around and have men again. And he said, I finally got into trouble. He was unhappy. He got into trouble. He slipped away, and he would go in his basement. He was making bombs and working with firearms. He left New Jersey, moved to California, and tried to find a way of life. He got in wrong in California, started playing with guns, drinking pills, was arrested, and that's when the police department started letting him off charges, arresting him, letting him off, until they began to use him as an agent. And he asked his lawyer, what should I do? And he said, well, if you have to serve yourself and get out, you know, become an informer for them. And he worked for them. He said, I worked in two jobs, and he tried very hard. He said his wife came back. I got her everything she wanted, TVs in every room. Her home looked better than a movie star's. He tried to hide his unhappiness and weakness. He worked 22 hours a day. He had no peace, and she wanted more. Then finally they sent him to Chino, and he tells about it. And that's what Don Fried was talking about. When they realized he was talking about God and had second feelings about the work he was doing for the LAPD, they sent him to dry him out, to unleash him. He wasn't good to them anymore because he was having second feelings. And he said, you sent me there, and I lied to them. I didn't tell the truth. I want to tell the truth now. They think I'm nuts. God has told me I would go home if I believed in him and changed my life and forgave everyone that did me wrong, and my wife also. And he pleads with the judge, and he gets home, and when he comes home, his wife is there having sex relations with some other man. So he's forced back out into the streets, and he comes to California to give himself up. He's ready to go to the court. I wanted to get away from her somehow, and I said to myself I would go with them, my wife and kids, to New Jersey and help them fix things up. It wasn't working, and he came to California. His wife kept asking for money. He had a chance to steal $1,500. He took just $100 and gave it to her, but he kept being driven back to the streets, and they had him on these petty robberies, and they used him. He said, sir, don't send me to prison again. I'm not a crook or a thief, nor am I crazy. I hope you will believe me. I am foolish, honest, and truly. I was very proud and very weak when it came to my wife, but that's over and gone. And if you ever call me back or want to see me again, thank you. Even if you don't, he says to the judge, if you don't call me back or want to see me again, thank you for all you've done, and all I can say is God bless you. That is the letter that Donald DeFries wrote. A black man in a society, no jobs waiting for them, used by the police department. Last week, if you heard the tape, you heard that pathetic a plea that Don Fried made of how our society uses these people instead of offering them opportunities. I couldn't feel worse about those murders in L.A. than if they were my own, for the simple reason that they are my own. This system, I believe, and I'm collecting evidence, did the same thing to my daughter. They didn't burn her alive, they crashed her alive a few years ago. And I'm watching. Donald Segretti was at the judge advocate's office of Fort Ord, involved a man at Fort Ord in an automobile accident. I sat and I watched the house on fire the other night, and I said to my daughter, how does Randolph Hearst sit there wondering if she's on fire? And I looked and I said, my God, they did it to our own, and I can't even relate. They're doing it again to somebody else's. You go through this shock thing, and you sit back, and you know they mean it for real. These people are ruthless, and there's no safety in silence, you people that sit there and don't speak up or shout. I'll shout till I die. And when I saw those people and knew they died, I said, I'd rather live 1 hour the way I'm living than to sit there like a zombie and let it happen and not speak up. And that's why we're here today. I'll see you next week.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for over 10 years has been researching the facts behind the political assassinations in this country so that the truth may be revealed. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KLRB-FM in Carmel, California.
And this is KLRB-FM in Carmel, and it's 1 minute after the hour of 6 o'clock.
If you're the type who likes to consult the leading consumer guides before making a major purchase, you're probably already familiar with Frigidaire, because Frigidaire appliances lead the way when it comes to any list of quality and reliability. But what's probably even more important is where you buy. For over 40 years, Kane & Zek has been servicing its customers. So for your next appliance, whether it be a refrigerator, a washer, dryer, or even a time and energy-saving microwave oven, you can rely on Frigidaire. And you can rely on Kane & Zek for fine service and low prices. 325 Main Street, Salinas.
Come on, you, sir. Step right in here. Yes, you.
Step into perfection, into the glorious vibrational atmosphere of sound reproduced through the sophisticated quadraphonic Pioneer QX747 receiver. To the provision for turntable, plug the dual 1216 with bass, dust cover, and Stanton 4DQ780 cartridge. 4 Bic Venturi speakers power the sound and fill your space through the complements of this positive reproduction process. The whole system, when purchased at Gramophones and Things, is reduced to $11.19, a savings of $225.80 from its usual cost of $13.34.80. Gramophones offers a substantial savings also on a high-quality cassette deck, the Technics RS-276. Tape production and playback is of proven excellence in this unit, reduced right now to $329.95 from $399.95, saving you $70. Gramophones and Things, 556 Abrego, Monterey, and inside McMahon, Salinas and Santa Cruz.
And we want you to know that there'll be a free clinic to be held by the Tanberg people to check the functioning of open reel decks. That's like reel-to-reel type tape recorders, not cassettes. This will be held from 1 o'clock to 7 o'clock p.m. this Wednesday, May 22nd. The clinic is by appointment only at Gramophone's Monterey store only, and you can call 372-7564, that's 372-7564, if you'd like to make an appointment to have your tape deck checked. And moving right along with things, we've got little Commander Cody right here.
I'm a guy with a heart of gold, the ways of a gentleman. I've been told the kind of guy who would never harm a flea. But if me and a certain character met the man who invented the cigarette, I'd murder that son of a gun in the first degree. Now it ain't cause I don't smoke myself, and I don't figure it'll hurt my health. I've been smoking for 25 years, ain't dead yet. But them nicotine slaves, they're all the same. At a petting party or a poker game, everything's gotta stop while you smoke that cigarette.
Smoke, smoke, smoke that cigarette.